Hey folks, this is the Contextual Insurgent Podcast, and I'm your host, Aaron Smith. I'm an activist, an analyst, a writer, and a sensemaker. I'm a Republican, a former SFGOP Central Committee Delegate, where I was the Deputy Vice Chair of Communications. As California GOP-endorsed State Senate candidate, where I managed to win 11% of the vote in San Francisco, which, trust me, is better than average. I've also been involved with the firearms community and Second Amendment rights. I was on the cover of Time magazine in November of 2018 for their Guns in America issue. But I'm probably best known for my free speech activism and facing off with hard lefties like Antifa in California and the Pacific Northwest since 2017. The general topic of this podcast series will be politics in the current culture war, as seen from my unique, rather hands-on experience and knowledge, but also intend to include a practical element focused on giving you the conceptual tools to build towards true grassroots, nonviolent political change. You may have noticed lefties usually seem to get what they want regardless of how elections go, and I want to help you change that. You can also sign up for my Substack newsletter at contextualinsurgent.substack.com. I have a weekly newsletter that looks back at some of the highlighted stories of the week and gives you some feedback and analysis of what's happening. If you'd like to support my work, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/EESmith4. That's the number 4. I also have a Cash App at $EESmith4. Again, that's the number 4. For the cost of a mocha frappuccino once a month, you can support my work, which is ultimately about helping you. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming back and joining me on my podcast. Today, I'm going to talk about something that I want to talk about the old left and the new left and some of the political changes that I think are coming up. And I think a great jumping off point for that was a little dust-up that happened over this past weekend with some of the redecorating choices Joe Biden has made in the Oval Office. You see, he added a bust behind the Resolute desk. I mean, he did a lot of things like, you know, take a bunch of, like, Andrew Jackson's picture out of it. But he also added a bust behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office of a man named Cesar Chavez, who was a labor organizer, a big labor organizer in the 60s and 70s in California. And he did a lot of work in the American Southwest. He was one of the main people that started the National Farm Workers Association, which became the Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, and later became the United Farm Workers Labor Union. So he was, you know, a leftist, definitely a very, you know, hard lefty type of guy. But the interesting thing, and why this was such a controversial choice, was that he was vehemently anti-immigration. And it's sort of interesting because There's a strain of anti-immigration and kind of border, you know, towards border control in the left, and it's been there for a while, and that's kind of what I want to talk about today. See, some more information on Cesar Chavez was, there used to be something called the Bracero program, and it was basically a guest worker program that people could live in Mexico and come across the border and work in the farm industry in the fields and go home at night, and Cesar Chavez was one of the main people pushing to shut that program down. Another thing he did that is extremely controversial is he essentially created something that can best be described as like a left-wing, like, death squad, labor death squad, I guess you could say. I don't know if any actual murders were linked. I can't find anything about actual murders linked to them confirmed or anything, but they definitely beat the hell out of a lot of people. Basically, he helped organize these paramilitary groups that went down to the border, and they would attack people that were there working illegally or crossing the border, and they called them wet lines. It was kind of a play on the slur of calling people who come across the border wetbacks. They called them wet lines. They were basically down there, a line paramilitary force patrolling the border and trying to keep people out. And the reason that he was so vehemently anti-immigration was that the assertion that it undermined the price of labor, you know, simple supply and demand. If you have more labor for a certain skilled or unskilled position, the price of labor drops. And this is sort of an interesting thing because that's actually been a strain on the left. There's been a very anti-immigration strain for a long time, and it's very easy to overlook that. We have a tendency in this country to treat people, the right and the left, it's monolithic. And, you know, I've done it for a while. Other people have done it. We've all been guilty of it at some point or at another. But even we all know on the right that there is a variety of different, you know, schools of thought on different things. And the left's the same way. There's definitely a divide between the old left and the new left, and probably the most prominent holdout of the old left on national politics, Bernie Sanders. So I have this clip from summer of 2015. It's an interview between Ezra Klein of Vox and Bernie Sanders talking about many things, but one of them was immigration. It's a fascinating interview because Ezra Klein is definitely a man of the new left, and Bernie Sanders had not yet been assimilated by the new left, I guess you could say. Anyway, I'm just going to roll this clip, and we'll pick up once it's over.
I think if you take global poverty that seriously, it leads you to conclusions that in the U.S. are considered out of political bounds. Things like sharply raising the level of immigration we permit, even up to a level of open borders, about sharply increasing
open
the
borders.
Amount of foreign aid.
Open no, borders. That's a Koch brothers proposal. The
really?
Idea. Of course. I mean, that's a right-wing proposal, which says essentially there is no United States.
But it would make a lot of global poor richer, wouldn't it?
And it'd make everybody in America poor. Then you're doing away with the concept of a nation state. And I don't think there's any country in the world which believes in that. If you believe in a nation state or in a country called the United States or UK or Denmark or any other country, you have an obligation, in my view, to do everything we can to help poor people. What right-wing people in this country would love is an open border policy. Bring in all kinds of people who work for $2 or $3 an hour. That would be great for them. I don't believe in that. I think we have to raise wages in this country. I think we have to do everything that we can to create the millions of jobs. You know what youth unemployment in the United States of America today? If you're white, a white kid, high school graduate, 33%, a Hispanic, 36%, African-American, 51%. You think we should open the borders and bring in a lot of low-wage workers? Or do you think maybe we should try to get jobs for those kids? So I think from a moral responsibility, we've got to do work with the rest of the industrialized world to address the problems of international poverty. But you don't do that by making people in this country even poorer.
Wow, that's a pretty based Bernie Sanders there. Definitely not the person we see today. I mean, Bernie has evolved a lot in his, obviously, his stated preferences for immigration, but it never really struck me as being an organic change of heart. It always kind of struck me as someone who saw the writing on the wall and what he had to do, and I still don't think he's hardly the most leading vanguard of open borders and bringing them all in the way that some of the other people in the Democratic Party are. But interesting, still, in 2015, like I said, he was probably the last holdout of the old-school Dems for their, you know, belief that immigration was something that was negative for the working class. And it's very interesting because you can hear Ezra Klein, even at the beginning of that clip, he obviously sees no moral difference between people that are his putative countrymen and foreigners around the world that may be poorer. And that is really kind of interesting. You know, there's been, we talk about globalization, and there is kind of this mobile class of, you know, it's almost like a fusion between kind of the upper class left and capitalism these days. And you really see that in Ezra's mindset there, where he doesn't really put his countrymen ahead of their interests, ahead of interests on someone else on the other side of the planet. The problem with that is, you know, we've seen this, the world is kind of tearing itself apart, partly because the idea that people can just, I mean, look, be honest, I love traveling. I spent 8 months in 2016 out of the country, living out of a backpack. I love traveling. I love visiting other countries. But you have to have some place to go back to. If you do not have a preference for the person in the country next to you or your neighbor, and you're willing to sell them out for someone on the other side of the planet, that really undermines a lot of the social trust and social capital that it takes to have a nation, to have a nation that works, where people aren't at each other's throats. I mean, I've had roommates I could not trust. Just an example, most of us have had at least one terrible roommate in our life. And we remember how hard that was to have someone in our living space that we did not trust and could not, you know, turn our backs on. And when they left, it was a relief. And kind of like, I hate to use the analogy to jump that much to a nation, to a house, but there is an element there of that. If you've got people living in this political construct alongside you that you know, you cannot trust that they will put your interests ahead of someone else's interests, then you're not going to have a lot of the social trust and social capital that a functional nation is going to need over the long term. Ezra's mindset really reminds me of an incident that happened in late 2019 that I saw. I was all over Twitter for a while. I've got it saved somewhere. I may add it in a Substack and talk about it. But it was a girl in Hong Kong in late 2019. She was a white American girl, apparently, it turned out, mid-20s, and she was counter-protesting the protesters. And it was very interesting because some of the Hong Kongers confronted her, and they're like, why are you here? This is not your city. And she's like, this is my city. And, you know, there was a lot of back and forth and anger, and people started, you know, giving her some crap about her statement that this was her city. And it's true. It's a really interesting illustration of her mindset, because obviously the people that she was counter-protesting were native Hong Kongers, and she's a white expat that's living there. She was actually wrong. She was wrong, but she was actually right in a sense. She was not a native-born Hong Konger. It wasn't her city in that sense. But she was correct in the same sense that, you know, Ezra Klein was kind of alluding to. He didn't actually say it, but his mindset is where this comes from, is there is another Hong Kong kind of on top of the original Hong Kong. There's this international capital of Hong Kong, and all these cities, like, I've traveled around the world, and it's very interesting because when you start traveling, especially if you're going out and partying, you'll start to see a lot of the same people in different cities. And her reaction to them really kind of illustrated that there's actually two Hong Kong stacked on top of each other. There's the people, the native people of an area whose history and family ties go back a long way. And then there's this transitory class of kind of upper class people that kind of bounce around and live in this layer on top of the original city. And like, I lived in San Francisco, and I've traveled around America, and I've traveled, you know, all over, and I've seen a lot of the same thing. I mean, there was probably a point where I was one of those people for a little while. The difference between Bernie and Ezra is not some minor little quibble or difference. It is a chasm. It is a fundamentally different worldview, and the way they see their place in the world, their duties to their countrymen, the reciprocal obligations that go alongside with it. And Ezra was in the process, his mindset and people like him, his allies, were in the process of displacing the people like Bernie and their mindset. The main takeaway I get from that, and it's something I've noticed, is if you travel enough, you start to see American, you know, I call it the mimetic empire. It's a kind of a play on the whole mimetic tribe thing. You start to see American stuff, our cultural hegemony, it's like everywhere. Like all of our stuff, you travel, it doesn't matter where you are. It's like you meet a place where no one speaks English, but they're probably wearing Nikes and has shirts with, you know, the swoosh on it, or American branding, McDonald's all over the place. The thing about like global capital and like capitalism, once it reaches a certain point, you know, it's all about efficiency and removing barriers to trade and flow of capital and people. Because, you know, it's all about efficiency. It's like the more similar people are, you know, the more you can sell stuff to them. And that's really like people like Ezra Klein and that girl in Hong Kong I were talking about. That's kind of the world that they're stuck into, and the world that they're reflecting, people that are part of this burgeoning class. And the reason I'm bringing that up is it sort of contrasts and helps explain a lot of what's changed on the left and where things are going on the right. I want to be clear, I'm not a socialist. I am not trying to turn you into socialism or be a Bernie supporter, but it's incredibly interesting just to look back and see where things have changed. And the reality is, Bernie did kind of have a point there. You know, there are a lot of right-wing people, more of the Chamber of Commerce Republican-style people, that have been massively about open borders and bringing in labor. If you're on some websites, certain forums you can go and you'll see people cheering on folks like Mike Lee or whatever that want to do, Senator Mike Lee that has like the H, or Mitt Romney, the people that are pushing like the H-1B program. There's folks out there like that. And there always has been for a while, especially when the Republican Party was more big business oriented, that was seriously about bringing in labor. I want to read a little excerpt from a report that was produced in May of 1910 by the Socialist Party of America on the topic of immigration. The larger and more powerful elements of our ruling classes, the great capitalists, the real and effective opponents of the militant working class, are the real beneficiaries of immigration from those countries, and being well aware that these immigrants are accustomed to a much lower standard of living and do not easily assimilate with the other elements of our population, use every means, legal and illegal, to encourage the immigration of these peoples to a point where it becomes an effective competitor against the progressive elements of the working class, serves to lower their standard of living, and constitutes a formidable factor in perpetuating division among the workers by subordinating class issues to racial antagonisms, and thus tends to prolong the system of capitalist exploitation. For this reason, the exclusion laws already on the statute books are not only not enforced, but are made largely inoperative by the influence of the powerful interests which desire that this immigration shall continue. That excerpt is really interesting because it's 110 years old. And notice it talks about not only undermining wages in the United States using immigration, it also talks about using racial tensions to increase the divide. One thing that was found out recently, a whistleblower pointed out that Amazon ranks the Whole Foods stores according to a number of factors that undermine unionization. And one of the big factors that they push is diversity, because when people are from different backgrounds and different everything, immigration and heritage and all that, apparently that lowers social trust and that lowers the ability for people to unionize. Because again, to unionize, you have to trust and know people around you. And it's a lot harder when you're trying to cross a cultural divide. Again, there's multiple factors involved there, but that was one of the factors. Another interesting thing is the Google Ngram plots, which is where you can go online and you can see like when words were used the most and when, how much their relative uses is over time. Like the words like racism and anti-racism and white privilege, all those things really started exploding in early 2012. Like it literally went up like 1,000%. And it was really interesting, especially like in the New York Times and a bunch of other publications. You can really drill down and look at it. But it's really interesting because what happened in 2011 was Occupy Wall Street. And there's been a lot of talk that, you wonder like, why are all these corporations funding and backing all these diversity initiatives and talking about, equity and anti-racism and identity politics? And we get a hint of that in that excerpt from the Socialist Party piece, from 1910, where they're talking about people using racial tensions and racial divide to increase their ability to keep people from unionizing, working together. And that's essentially what the TLDR there is. Corporations got woke in 2012, starting in 2012, because in 2011 they were terrified of going broke and they wanted to distract people from the economic concerns that were being raised by focusing people on racial concerns, which, the socialists talked about that over a century ago. On the legislative side, the biggest pro-immigration bill in the last 40 years was under Republican President Ronald Reagan, the Simpson-Mazzoli Act of 1986, which had some stipulations about securing the border, but, TBD, to be decided about funding it, and surprise, surprise, it didn't get funded. But it also provided amnesty to millions of people that had been in the country illegally up till like late 1982. And that's like the biggest amnesty we've had, I was in my lifetime for sure. That's like the last big amnesty push we had. The two biggest anti-immigration bills we had were actually under Democratic President Bill Clinton. We had the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And I'm probably going to mangle this up. It's called IRA-IRA. The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996. Yes, I mangled that. I had to actually record that little clip there separately and then insert it. It was a fairly strong bill. It made it much easier to fast-track deportations, made it much harder to get legalized, and made it much easier to get deported. It didn't just apply to illegal immigrants. It also applied to legal residents as well. Something else to keep in mind is one of the other things that Reagan signed in 1986 was the EMTALA Act, which was the one that basically hospitals can't turn you away from getting treated. One of the stipulations of that act was hospitals could not turn away illegal immigrants. Again, I'm not trying to make you a Democrat or socialist, and even if I was, the Democrats and the socialists that I'm talking about in this podcast, that party doesn't exist anymore. Why did it go away? Well, people are debating that. My personal thought goes back to what I was talking about with Occupy Wall Street. It's like the left got so radical and so threatening to the powers that be that they basically bought them off. Noam Chomsky, of all people, again, here I am quoting leftists, but they've talked about a lot of this stuff. He wrote, a book called Manufacturing Consent that talked about how a lot of the mainstream media is essentially a propaganda organ. And when you have people like Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post, well, he made that purchase for a reason. And maybe it has nothing to do with making a profit from the Washington Post. Propaganda organs can come in pretty handy, to be honest. I'm going to segue here and replay a little clip I played a few episodes ago in the counterinsurgency episode. It was the clip by General Stanley McChrystal. And I want you to listen to this clip again and remember what you heard with Bernie, and I'll pick it up once it's over.
White men started losing ground. They started losing their privileged position. And what that meant was they lost some of it to the equal rights movement for gender, for women. They lost some of it to the civil rights movement. They lost some of it to the globalization of the economy. So the relatively and maybe undeserved privileged position that a white worker had for generations was suddenly under threat. And that caused great frustration. That caused a sense of loss. And we've seen that for several decades now. It was also matched by fear. Fear that they would be displaced in society. In fact, be in a position of the oppressed, vice the oppressor, such as they had seen minorities before. And so when you put together frustration and fear, you get the combination of desperation, or you get the output of desperation. And so suddenly they become fertile ground for accepting things that they want to believe. They want to believe that all of this is the result of a conspiracy. They want to believe that there are evil people doing this to them, and they want to believe that there are relatively simple fixes to it.
Wow, that's some pretty aggressive grievance politics there from General Stanley McChrystal. It's almost hard to believe that you're hearing that from someone who used to lead the Ranger Regiment and was commander of American forces in Afghanistan, compared to what you just heard 20 minutes ago from Bernie Sanders, who's a literal democratic socialist. That's 5 years of time between those two clips. The one from Stanley McChrystal was sometime last week, was recorded on the Sam Harris podcast, and the clip I just played from Bernie Sanders was from, I think, April or May of 2015, something like, I'd have to double check the date, but yeah, right around April, May of 2015. I mean, that's a little over 5 years, and the discourse between the two is so dramatically different. A couple of things to note here is, obviously, that podcast was not directed at the white working class. It was directed more at your urban democratic elite, which, like, basically Ezra Klein and people in that cohort. Another thing, too, to remember is, again, I touched on this in a previous episode, whiteness is not really a racial or ethnic identity as much these days as it used to be. This is something that we will always want to touch on a good bit in this podcast, because it's so common. There's a semantic trick that the left plays where it's sort of like a Mott and Bailey, but not really. They'll use a word in a fundamentally different way. And one of those is white and whiteness. There's actually a thing they've been pushing more and more lately, talking about multiracial whiteness, which sounds absurd on its face, but then again, this is the party and the ideology that talks about socially constructed identity. So if whiteness is socially constructed, then of course it makes sense that you could have a multiracial whiteness. And they mainly started pushing this to cover up the fact people started noticing, why are there so many like Trump supporters that are not white? Why you know, especially like also with the Proud Boys, it's like they're led by a mixed race, like an Afro-Cuban gentleman, you know, like stuff like that. They're like, wait, how do you have white supremacy and whiteness when it's so much of it is not, you know, obviously not white? There was a comment during the campaign by Joe Biden where he said, if you vote for Trump, you're not black. And he was speaking to a black audience. And that's kind of offensive and absurd on its face, but it really goes back to what I was talking about there, which is the whole multiracial whiteness. It's not just enough to be a certain race or ethnicity or identity. There's a performative aspect to it as well. If you want to completely embody whatever it is about that identity, and they tie it to political activity, like you need to vote these certain ways. And this is something as an LGBT person, we see this a lot. In fact, Chadwick Moore and like Milo Yiannopoulos, and I believe it was Peter Thiel, they were in particular, they were accused of not actually being gay because they were Republicans. And it's, they're like, you know, just because you're a man who has sex with men, you can't, that's not enough to make you gay. You have to hold these particular policy choices and you have to vote for these people. And there's a very performative cultural aspect to it. And you see the left a lot, especially like the new left, really pushing that angle where they're kind of having the Mott and Bailey thing where, you know, you have these immutable characteristics that they want to harp on, but at the same time, these immutable characteristics have to come with certain political, ideological actions that you have to actually perform these things if you want to complete whatever your identity is. It's all kind of really absurd, and it's like a mishmash. And the whole thing is, really, you have to understand they're not being honest. So don't get, you're not dealing with, when you hear this sort of stuff from them and they're pushing that angle, you probably already know this, but just in case you haven't, they're not dealing in good faith. To kind of bring this back to full circle to the main point of doing this particular podcast episode is I want to kind of give you an idea of where we're going to be moving forward from here. McChrystal was very dishonest with the way he framed his statements. He tried to frame it so it would sound good to his audience and put the people he was discussing, the white working class that he denigrated so badly, in the worst light possible. Again, we just covered he wasn't just talking about the white working class. And besides, white working class people now are pretty much a stand-in for any person that is a red state flyover working class or middle class person with center right or more values. It doesn't matter what race you are. Even when they say white, they're really kind of, even if you're black, if you fit that definition, when they talk about, you know, white working class or white men, he's still pretty much talking about you. It really comes down to three things: immigration, trade, and war. That really determines where you are on the political spectrum these days. And that's what's leading this major reshuffling that we're seeing right now. I have talked before about the end of the six-party system and how we're in the process of resorting the American political landscape into the seventh-party system. And whatever comes out of that, the three big questions, again, are immigration, trade, and war. That's going to really determine where you wind up. Part of this reshuffling is we've seen people align with folks you wouldn't normally expect. Like, for example, there is a certain faction of former Bernie supporters that became Trump supporters. Probably one of the most notable ones I can think of off from the top of my head is like Cassandra Fairbanks. I even think Tim Pool. I believe Tim Pool was a Bernie guy as well. Now he was a Trump supporter. So you're seeing this sort of stuff where people are reshuffling. And on the right, we've got a bunch of former establishment GOP types that are now Biden supporters, and they're moving into alignment with sort of that urban, middle-upper class. Again, third time, not trying to make you a communist or a Bernie fan. I think the real objective that I want to get across here is, because things are such in flux right now and will be for the foreseeable future, you need to be alert and aware that you're going to start finding allies in places that you never expected. And you're also going to find people that used to be your allies or probably not for much longer. I think we're going to start seeing more people from kind of the Libertarian Party, kind of the right libertarian school of thought, start moving towards the whole social justice and anti-cop thing. Like, we did see this during last summer, and even now, you know, it's like a lot of these libertarians and Joe Jorgensen, for example, are very much about like racial equity and social justice. On the other hand, I think we're going to see a lot of people involved with like organized labor and other leftists that were kind of like Tim or Cassandra, people that may technically have been on the left, but their issues were things that are now shifting towards more of the right-leaning perspective. I think we'll see more people like that. And it's kind of interesting with the labor part of it. I don't think we'll get the unions themselves to move anytime soon because they're so deeply entwined with the Democratic Party. But I think we have a chance to maybe make some serious inroads with the rank and file union member, and who knows from there, maybe they can build something from the ground up. I can think of a few complicating factors as well. The fact is, so many of these leftist organizers, they don't just stay in one area. Like, they may work with organized labor, and then they'll go to climate change or social justice topics. It's basically a big circulating ecosystem of people getting training and experience. A good example of that is Lisa Fithian. I talked about her in a previous podcast, and I linked to an article in one of my newsletters. It was written by David Hines. It was called "The World That Made Lisa Fithian in the American Conservative." And it really talked about that whole ecosystem that I was just explaining, because she started in organized labor and then she moved on to like climate change stuff. She was actually one of the head people with Shutdown DC, which was the organization that was essentially planning to overthrow Trump if he managed to pull off winning the election. The information I went over here, interesting and illuminating. I wanted to give you a good overview of the changes that have happened in politics over the last 100 years or so. The important thing to remember is we have a tendency to confuse principles and policies. Things like immigration and trade policy, that's all policies. That's not, that shouldn't be a principle. You know, it's all about the principle that we should try to follow is we want to try to give the best existence possible for the people in our nation. You know, we want to have a happy, healthy nation with happy, healthy people and healthy family formations. And our policies, whether or not it's dealing with trade or immigration, should ideally, you know, be conducive to that. The next few years are going to be pretty wild as things resort and settle down. So just be open-minded. Expect to find allies where you didn't expect to find them. Again, I'm going to reiterate that. I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict that the ultimate deciding question is going to be around how we organize society. That is going to be the thing driving and ultimately defining the two different camps. On one hand, you can be a localist and you can believe that people in some sort of proximity and within the political construct with you that share at least some basic civic religion and beliefs and heritage, whether or not that involves ethnicity at all, just at least some intertwined ancestry of people in history, whether that matters. Or if you want to be on the other team and you have some supranational transactional identity that is ultimately unmoored from any real human connection or concrete reality. Think of Ezra Klein's reaction in that Bernie clip when Bernie's like, basically, no, it's like, I prefer people in my country over someone on the other side of the planet. And Ezra was completely dumbfounded that anyone would even hold that idea, much less express it publicly. Or I could be wrong. One way or the other, I suspect we're going to find out soon enough. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to me ramble. I hope you found this educational. This is Aaron Smith at the Contextual Insurgent Project.